Good afternoon, and welcome to Research Plus Pizza, which is a lunchtime lecture series brought to you by the University of Texas Libraries and featuring research presentations by faculty from across the university and pizza, courtesy of our generous program supporter, Austin's Pizza. I'd ask you to please hold your questions until after Dr. Bigler's presentation, because today's program, like all of our programs, is being recorded for podcast. We'd appreciate it if you would raise your hand if you have a question and then wait for me to bring you the microphone. You don't have to say who you are or anything like that, unless you want to, but I'll bring you the microphone and then we can capture you for the podcast. Also, if you would please fill out the feedback form, there's probably a stack of them on a chair at the end of a row if you're sitting here. If you're sitting out there, I will find you and bring you one. And then you can tell us what you thought of today's program. Also, give us suggestions for future topics and for future presenters. And you can also sign up to get on our mailing list so that we can notify you when we start up this program again in the fall. So today's program was made possible by the UT Libraries. They're full of good resources and friendly, helpful folks. And for more information on finding articles on the research that will be discussed today, you can check out this research guide, or you can contact the Psychology, Women, and Gender Studies librarian, Carolyn Cunningham. She will now introduce today's presenter.
Rebecca S. Bigler is professor of psychology and women's and gender studies and is a supporter of gender-neutral language. Dr. Bigler uses the pronouns Z, here, and hears. Z received a BA from Oberlin College and PhD from the Pennsylvania State University before joining the faculty at UT Austin in 1991. Dr. Bigler studies the causes and consequences of social stereotyping and prejudice among children, with a particular focus on gender and racial attitudes. Z develops and tests ways to reduce children's social stereotyping and intergroup biases. Her research has appeared in top developmental psychology journals and has been covered by major media outlets. Her work has been supported by Teaching Tolerance and the National Science Foundation. Z is currently the executive director of the American Council for Co-Educational Schooling. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Rebecca Bigler.
And I'll start by saying I am delighted to be here, and the sound people can make sure that my mic sounds good. And in case I forget to say this later, I want to start out by just inviting you to contact me if I can be helpful to you in any way down the road. I'm in the psychology department. You Google my name, my contact information comes up, and I love to be helpful to students and community members alike. So if there's any way that I can answer questions, send you to resources, etc., I am super happy to do so. Okay. Today I'm going to talk to you about the relationship between gendered thought or gendered language and sexist thought, and I'm going to go ahead and tell you my thesis that I'm going to argue. I'm going to argue that gendered language causes sexist thought. So words refer to concepts, and having a word for something affects the way that we think about it. In my talk, I will summarize new and striking evidence that the mere use of words to label or mark or denote gender, referred to as gendered language, facilitates the development of gender stereotyping and gender prejudice among children. So, in other words, gendered language causes sexist thought in children. So I want to just quickly say no researcher, you know, works alone in a bubble. These are two of my important colleagues, and I want to acknowledge their contributions to my talk. So let's get to language. Languages across the world vary in the extent to which they mark gender and the ways in which they do so. For today, I am going to focus on English. The English language includes many means of marking gender, including honorific titles such as Ms., Mrs., Miss, Mr., occupational titles such as garbage man, salesman, waitress, housewife, etc., nouns, woman, lady, granddaughter, grandpa, and many pronouns, he, she, his, hers, herself. 2 points about gendered language are important. First, words that denote gender in English use a binary system There are two dichotomous markings, male and female. There is no linguistic convention in English for marking individuals who fall outside of or between the categories male and female. And second, it is typically but not always possible to use gender-neutral rather than gendered nouns to label people. And thus, speakers can opt or not to specify someone's gender in a statement. There are obviously contexts in which it is pertinent to mark someone's gender, for example, when discussing gender discrimination. In the vast majority of instances, however, individuals' gender is marked unnecessarily, as when teachers greet students with expressions such as, "Good morning, boys and girls," or "Let's line up, boy, girl," or when a parent informs a spouse, "I'll pick up the girls from school today." Unlike nouns, however, English singular third-person pronouns require, they mandate the marking of gender. And as a consequence, it is nearly impossible in English to write or talk about other people without indicating their gender and simultaneously forcing them into a gender binary category of male or female. So what, you might ask? One possible response is that gendered language reifies a binary view of gender that is unacceptable because it does not allow representations of identities that fall outside of or between male and female. And indeed, some individuals do indeed claim identities that fall outside of or between male and female. For this reason alone, I would argue it is sufficient to call for linguistic reform. However, that is not the only basis to call for linguistic reform. Although the routine labeling of gender via nouns and pronouns has a long accepted history in the US, there is mounting evidence of harmful consequences associated with the practice, especially among children. Empirical evidence suggests that rather than being innocuous, gendered language profoundly affects children's gender stereotyping and prejudice. And it does through two processes, categorization and conceptualization. It is now well established that language affects children's categorization of both inanimate and animate objects. In the words of Roger Brown, words serve as invitations to form categories, and infants and preschoolers readily accept such invitations. The clearest demonstration of the power of labels to induce categorization comes from 20 years of work by a woman named Sandra Waxman. Waxman and her colleagues have shown that infants between 3 months of age and 2 years of age respond differently to the identical stimuli as a function of whether they are given the same label or unlabeled. For example, Booth and Waxman presented 14-month-old babies with small models of familiar stimuli, such as cars and horses. Some were labeled with the same noun, and others were not. On test trials, infants were more likely to select a familiar rather than a novel category object only if they had been exposed to labels. In later work, the authors extended the finding to novel objects, eliminating the possibility that the words merely called to mind already existing categories. Infants who heard novel objects labeled with the same noun were more likely, for example, to respond to the perceptual commonalities among objects than babies who did not hear labels, despite the fact that the perceptual commonalities were still there. Categorization, in turn, affects conceptualization. Categorization induces what's called essentialist reasoning about categories in children. Essentialist reasoning is defined as the tendency to believe that things, category objects, have deep natures or essences that make them what they are and make them similar to each other. Susan Gelman and her colleagues have an impressive array of evidence. The category labels leads children to infer that members share deep, meaningful, inherent commonalities, even in the absence of perceptual similarities. Consistent with this notion, preschool children readily make gender stereotypic inferences about unfamiliar children merely on the basis of their gender category labels. Thus, children raised in the presence of pervasive noun labels for gender are likely to categorize other people by gender and assume that the two genders are similar to each other in deep, inherent, meaningful ways. Given that essentialist thought characterizes children's views of social categories, the learning of gender categories is likely to promote gender stereotyping. Indeed, categorization is a key component of nearly all theories of prejudice. In 2006, I published a major theory of processes involved in the development of stereotyping and prejudice. And in a nutshell, we noticed that people differ on myriad numbers of characteristics. So when you look at an audience, you vary by height, weight, whether earlobes are attached or not, whether you're right or left-handed, whether you're tall or short or fat or skinny or one religion or another. The child's job is to figure out which of those dimensions are important. What way am I supposed to group you? Am I supposed to use your earlobes, your handedness, your height? What language does is mark the category that is important for children. So children attend to the linguistic labeling as a cue that, oh, this is what's important. So a child who goes to school and hears, good morning, boys and girls, and what a good girl, and let's have the boys get their pencils, and let's sit boy, girl, becomes convinced that their gender is what is the important thing about them, and that girls are different from boys. I went on to test this idea in domains outside of gender. In my typical paradigm, children come to summer school. They are placed in red or blue shirts, so a category they have never heard of. And then teachers either ignore those shirts, so they say, put your work shirts on, wear your shirts today, but they never use noun labels or adjectives to label the children. Or in other classrooms, they treat it like gender. So they say, good morning, reds and blues line up, and reds line up, and what a smart red group member. The labeling alone, we know, causes stereotyping and prejudice based on color group, so that after 4 weeks of school, the red kids claim they are smarter, nicer than the blue kids, and prefer to play with their own shirt kids, even though shirts were randomly assigned. Here are some examples. Changing linguistic practice. Because the use of gendered labels, nouns, and pronouns appears to precipitate a cascading sequence of gender salience, gender categorization, gender stereotyping, and gender prejudice, some individuals have called for the elimination of the routine use of non-purposeful gender labels. Teachers, for example, could refrain from using gender to label children and organize their classrooms. Imagine, for example, that a teacher greets the students with, good morning, blacks and Latinos. Let's have the Asians get their backpacks. Let's sit white, Latino today. Most people chuckle at this thought. That actually violates federal law in the United States. And yet the parallel uses of gender are rampant and widely accepted. Consistent with the idea that this practice may be bad, some U.S. colleges have instituted policies that minimize labeling and classification, including the creation of all-gender dorms and all-gender bathrooms. Oberlin, for example, uses an E system. Bathrooms are marked with an E for everyone as the default setting, but a student who is uncomfortable while they are in the bathroom can rotate that E to be up and be a W, or rotate it down to be an M, and then return it to the E position when they're done. These are other forms of labeling. What's important to note, though, is these won't solve the problem because they still mark gender as important. They still say to children, your gender is important to where you use the bathroom. This would be the ideal marking of a toilet in a non-gendered world. Finally, although it is possible for speakers to avoid gendered nouns, it is not possible for them to avoid the use of gendered pronouns, he, she. The absence of this non-gendered pronouns is problematic for many reasons, but one of the ones I have just argued is that empirical evidence suggests they lead to gendered thought and sexist beliefs among children. To address this problem, an increasing number of speakers and writers are using new gender-neutral pronouns, such as he and here, as a way to get around this issue. In the last year, I have come to refer to myself and request that others refer to me using gender-neutral pronouns. Z and here is my preference. The request derives from my conviction that altering linguistic input to youth, including the elimination of such labels and the introduction of gender-neutral pronouns, is an essential component of efforts to prevent stereotyping and prejudice from developing in the first place and reducing levels of bias once it's formed among youth. I would, in fact, argue that it is a necessary, albeit not sufficient, component of the prevention of stereotyping and prejudice based on gender. It is my hope and belief that freeing children from prospective and prescriptive beliefs about gender will lead them to lead happier, more fulfilling, more productive lives. Thank you. That's
okay. If you have questions for Dr. Bigler, just okay, and someone does, and here I come with the microphone.
So, like you said, we want to stop using these, but like you said, it's also extremely hard or even impossible to avoid using them. Do you suggest that, you know, we all just learn to speak the language differently?
Yes. So, yes, I'm an advocate for teaching kids to say "ze" and "here." One of the responses I commonly get is, that's too hard. Oh, it'll be really hard to get people to say "ze" and "here." Or some other convention, and I want to acknowledge there are other conventions for gender-neutral pronouns. I would simply argue that humans have the ability to learn an entirely different language. I say to people, you could learn German or French, or you can't tell me you can't learn two words, Z and here. So I really don't think it's hard. I think it's a matter of making the commitment to try. So we and my family try, and we actually enjoy, for example, I have my sister, see how hard this is, my sister has kids, and sister is gendered, so I have to say my sibling has kids, and I can't say niece or nephew, right, because that's, you can't even talk about a niece and nephew without labeling their gender, which is, so then you have to make up some other terms if there doesn't even exist a word. So I'll talk about my sibling's children, and they call me Ankle Becky, because I don't want to be Aunt Becky, which makes, so we explain the reasons, and sometimes have to make up new words where there just doesn't exist a label.
Hi. Has your research ever delved into the history of when language started to become more gendered or when some of these words were introduced? Because as I understand it, in Old English, it was a little more fluid. There wasn't maybe as much gendered language. And why at that point in history these things started to come into play?
That's a great question. I do not know the answer. I do know that there is evidence of the use of gender-neutral pronouns that dates back centuries. So this is not a new idea to have a gender-neutral pronoun. That has been around for centuries. I don't know the answer to your question. I can tell you there is vast variation across languages in how much they mark gender. English falls about in the middle. There are some languages that don't mark gender at all routinely. So when you talk about a person, you don't ever mark them as male or female. That includes languages like Hungarian. On the other end, of course, many of you know Spanish, the Romance languages, where they mark gender even more than they do. So you can't even say the table without marking a gender, male or female, or sometimes neutral. So we're about in the middle, and we at least don't have the problem of having to get rid of, right, all of the marking of nouns as male or female. The evidence, I do want to be clear, is language isn't the only component, right? Just because Hungarian doesn't mark gender doesn't mean that you wouldn't have sexism in Hungary, because this is a complex problem, sexism, as all the isms are. So language is just one component. But it does seem to me that if the language marks it routinely, you are telling children that they need to pay attention to gender, and children then will assume that the genders are different. Oh, you're labeling gender because it's really important whether I'm a girl or a boy, and therefore they think girls are like this and boys are like this, and then they show preference for their own gender, and you go down the pathway of stereotyping.
Do you think the singular they is more all-encompassing and probably easier to learn than Z or here?
It may well be. I don't know of a study that compares how easy it is to learn Z versus they. someone could do that research and argue that it's easier, but I don't know right now. I can tell you my preference just comes out of liking to know whether something's singular or plural. So if someone says they went to get their food, I won't know whether that's singular or plural. So I prefer Z because when you say Z went to get your food, you're like, oh, I know that's singular. Z is a... But that's my personal preference, and I don't have a big stake in what gender-neutral pronoun gets adopted. Like, if the country had a referendum and they picked they, I'd become a they.
So what kind of individual difference would you expect to the acquisitions of these items? In other words, who would find it easier to acquire this new system? Who would find it more difficult?
I don't know which individual differences would predict. We do know a lot about the individual differences that predict attitudes towards adopting gender-neutral pronouns, and I think it's not a surprise. Those people who are more gender egalitarian are more favorable toward having gender-neutral pronouns. People with more traditional, more sex-typed attitudes about gender, people who endorse the view that there are men and women, and they are different, and we need to keep them different, right? It's good that women are nurturing and soft, and they make a bunch of category attributions, and men are like this. Those people don't support gender-neutral language. In terms of, right, then going on to learn that, it may be that if you're predisposed to believe in a world that frees children from the constraints of this is what boys are like, so this is what, you know, people in this category should do, you might learn that system more quickly and readily and easily than someone who doesn't like the idea, the rationale for that kind of system. But I can just tell you, my family members range, you know, I have a 75-year-old dad who, when I first said, you have to call me Z, was like, you're kidding me, right? That's well outside of what his view would have been. I've really found that they all have come along. They practice. They don't always do it right, but we laugh really hard. My dad wrote an email note. It's basketball season, and he wrote a note about a team playing Z on Z defense. And I laughed because that's not quite right. It might be more like person-on-person defense in a zone versus a zone. But, you know, here he is trying at 75, raised in the 50s, when this goes pretty much against his gender, you know, his gender ideology for most of his life.
But would it go back to the same old questions of whether it's language that affects cognitions or cognitions that affects the language, right?
Yes.
So certain kind of conceptual predispositions would actually help people to acquire this new system. So how would you be able to solve the one leads to which?
And let me just acknowledge, the speaker brings up a good point. We know that language affects thought. It changes how people thought. But at the same time, thought, how we think, seems to affect the language that we use, right? So there are causal directions in both arrows. And some evolutionary theorists, for example, will say to me, they'll laugh, oh, cute idea, you will never get rid of that, because people want to think about gender, right? They label gender because their thought is demanding, their natures, right? Their evolutionary genetic heritage says, you need to pay attention to gender. Again, one argument against that is there are languages that don't do that at all. If Hungarians have for centuries had a language that never marks a person as male or female, surely we don't need to do it. And furthermore, every bit of evidence suggests that we can overcome our evolutionary nature, so that certainly we could say Z in here and readily learn to do that, even though there might have been pressures to pay attention to gender in contexts, right, that are more widespread than they are today in our evolutionary past. So again, I'm just this optimist that thinks, of course we could learn to say Z in here if we wanted to. It's simple, it's not a big deal. And furthermore, it wouldn't, I don't think, profoundly affect or cause a dysfunction in something we do. We don't, for example, label lots of other categories, and yet we know what we are. Sometimes people say, if you don't label, if you don't say what a good boy, boys won't even know what they are. They'll be so confused about their gender. And that, frankly, is preposterous, right? Children will discover their own gender if you don't say, good morning, boys and girls line up, and let's have girls go to the bulletin board.
Thank you for your fantastic presentation. So you mentioned that one difficulty with adopting these kinds of gender-neutral pronouns is when you're discussing gender discrimination. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, so I'm not an advocate for what you might call gender-blind language. In the case of race, you've seen in the U.S. white people adopt what's called color blindness, the ideology if we just never, ever speak of race, the whole thing will go away. We know now that is not true, and being colorblind is not an effective way to handle and dismantle and prevent racism. And the same is true for gender. So I'm not gender blind. I'm not arguing we should never talk about what it means to be a boy versus a girl. And in explaining to children gender discrimination, which we do in our work, we do interventions to reduce stereotyping and prejudice, in which we talk about gender and what it means, and we talk about sexism and what that means. And so I think there's a place for that. What I want to see banned, or right, strongly discouraged, is the routine labeling of gender. Labeling it for no reason whatsoever. When you say, ask the lady to get that, when there's no reason, you could say, ask the black person to get that, ask that chubby person to get that, right? Ask the Catholic to get that. I want to talk about gender when there's a reason to convey to children what their gender means, what it doesn't mean, the way in which it's valuable, the way in which it's, right, meaningless. Those are important conversations to have with kids.
Hi. I was wondering if you could speak to the way socioeconomic class or ethnicity affects someone's predisposition to being receptive or unreceptive to gender-neutral language.
Yeah, attitudes about gender are linked mostly to education level, right? The more education level in the U.S., the more likely you are to endorse egalitarian attitudes about gender. There are much weaker links to anything else, including race and ethnicity. So we often find levels of stereotyping do not differ in our research across Latinos, whites, African-American children, and they don't differ much across class, although we don't always have really the right real big spectrums of class. We're often looking at middle class kids. I think where you might see the big difference is in education level. People who understand the rationale better, have more education about the way that gender limits children in terms of the impact on society might be more accepting than people who have less information at their fingertips about such issues.
Hi. I wanted to ask about as far as I could tell, the basic problem that you're trying to address, which is the natural tendency to assume that labels have greater significance than they necessarily do, right?
Yes. So what research in child development in the area of cognition has shown is that humans come predisposed to view categories a certain way, probably because categorization is a really important part of functioning in humans, that humans are evolved to categorize, and even infants are just crazy categories. They are super good at categorizing within 2 months after birth. And the idea is we do this with objects because it's really important, right? You have to know a chair is a chair, and you don't have to say, oh my gosh, it's a different color. What do I do with it? What is it? Right? You just say chairs all have this similar purpose no matter what they look like. I don't have to treat them as individual exemplars. I'm going to make a rule. Chairs do this. This is what they're for. And then animals, right? We say things to kids like cows say moo. That's what cows do. Cows say moo. Dogs bark, right? Cats have fur. And then we say, and women. Women are nurturing. So part of the problem is humans come with some cognitive wiring that sets them up to be stereotypers because they categorize and do this with inanimate objects, and then they do it with people. So that's the problem I'm dealing with. And so my solution is to say that adults should be very careful what they categorize, right? What they use as a basis for categorization. linguistically, because it has powerful consequences. And maybe the cows don't care when you stereotype them as saying moo, even though some cows don't, right? Well, there aren't terrible social consequences if you think the cow says moo and it doesn't. But if you think that women are bad at math, when that's not true, there are consequences, and we know this for our country, right? Because of the lack of women going into STEM fields, there are real repercussions to saying women are like this and men are like this.
Right. Oh, I'm sorry. I meant to follow that with, I mean, if it's a mistaken categorization, then how would adding an additional category address that unless you, I mean, I guess that, you partially addressed it in that you would want to eliminate the old pronouns and have only the new ones. Would that also include individuals that view themselves as particularly masculine and feminine would want to be referred to as he and she?
Yes, you are absolutely right. Excellent point. Adding a third category doesn't help. Male, women, and then, right, we don't know, right? Inside, outside, Zs. I am advocating getting rid of the he, she. I want all the pronouns to be neutral. Now, I also want to be clear that I am not myself in the category of someone who has felt like their gender falls outside of or between male or female. I'm what they call cisgender, in that I was labeled a girl at birth and I have felt that way. And that influences my thinking, right? So I want to acknowledge that my solution then would take away an identity for an individual, for example, a transgender individual who says, I want an identity that's not he or she, I want my own unique label. And for example, says, I don't want you in my category, right? You are cisgender, I am not. I want a label for me that's separate and unique. And that's a point that is a difficult point. When I first wanted to adopt Z in here, one of the people I talked to is Shane Wally, who is gender neutral or gender queer. Shane was the education director for the Gender and Sexuality Center. And Shane said to me, look, I'm a Z because I have to be, right? I am not a person who is male or female, and my use of gender pronouns comes out of a dire personal need. And here you are saying, call me Z, when you don't have a dire personal need, right? We're not in the same category. And honestly, I did not come out as asking to be called Z until Shane told me that Z approved. So Shane and I had multiple conversations. Eventually, Shane said to me, you're good. I'm now convinced that this is a good idea and you should be a Z just like I am. But that is not everyone's position, absolutely. So, but you're right. Having three categories in some ways doesn't make it any better, right? It's equivalent of if we labeled your race every time we talked, well, oh, we should have a multiracial label and we should have a biracial label. But still, we should use it every time we talk about you.
Thank you for your great presentation. I was curious whether in your research you've come across like any studies about people maybe looking at the difference between integrating gender-neutral language textually versus like in communication, and just like the difference between like learning it audibly versus like seeing it in text and having that reinforced. And the reason I was thinking about that was just that a lot of people learn like to use like LOL, like a lot of new like conventions, and that's become part of the, you know, parlance. And so I was just wondering if you'd heard anything about that.
No, I know nothing about that. And it's a great question. I would love to see a whole bunch of new research on gender neutral pronouns and what how hard they are to learn, what children need to learn them, like how children might approach them differently than someone who has used he and she for 50 years, like many of us who are older. I suspect children would do it much more quickly and easily and readily. And as you mentioned, I mean, we introduce new words all the time in all the languages. So we know humans are totally capable of adopting new words. So I hope I've convinced some of you to adopt Z in here, or at least now that you have heard of this, when you encounter people who ask to be called Z or here, or they in there, that you are more readily willing and happy to comply. And as I said, you contact me if I can be helpful in any way in the psych department to you in the future. I'd be delighted to be.
Thank you very much. All right, there are these little half sheets here. We want to know what you thought about the program. We want your suggestions for the future. And this half sheet is the opportunity for you to get on our mailing list so that when we come back with this program in the fall, we can send you a notice about what we have going on. Thanks very much for coming and eating all the food. Good job. And we'll see you in September.